Hi, this is Paul Ingram of PainScience.com, and this is my odd little podcast of audio versions of blog and newsletter posts, which are in turn generally the extracted and excerpted updates from much larger articles and books in the main library of PainScience.com. Today is a particularly good example of that. Back in February, I completely overhauled a chapter in my back pain ebook about manual examination. It's about 10 times longer than it was, many more references, a lot of work, probably spent 10 or 15 hours on it. Everyone who has ever bought either of those books from me or any of the other 8 books that I publish has access to all updates forever. And they could have logged in to read them if they'd known that they were there. But the point of the blog and the podcast is to tell you that it's there, to showcase it, and also to deliver it to paying members like yourself, regardless of whether or not you've ever bought the book. So this is what I've written about the diagnostic accuracy of physical examination for back and neck pain. This is the back pain version. The neck pain version is very similar, but there are a few differences. And it's a beefy one. This is about 4,000 words, so it's going to take roughly half an hour to read to you. So, diagnose-schmiagnose, physical exam accuracy for spinal pain is poor. That's my title, and we begin like this. With a cliche. We can put a man on the moon, but diagnosing specific problems in the back is still too giant a leap. Mostly, especially by hand in a physical exam, which seems to be not much better than pointing at random anatomy while blindfolded. It is truly difficult to find biomechanical boogeymen, even when they do exist, when abnormalities that matter actually are haunting a spine. Healthcare professionals have an extremely tough time identifying them, either in a physical exam and or with any kind of medical test or scan. It's not hopeless, but confident and specific diagnosis of spinal pain is a bit of a medical unicorn, unlike the kind of definitive and specific explanations that we have for so many other diseases. This is a major reason why the idea of non-specific spinal pain is a thing, because it's just so difficult to be sure of a specific cause. Let's compare and contrast manual and medical testing. This chapter zooms in on physical testing. Can you move like so? Does that hurt? Medical testing is covered in another chapter, and then there's still more chapters devoted to specific kinds of medical testing like MRI and nerve blocks. But there is some overlap between the manual and the medical, and they're often combined. So let's compare and contrast. A competent physical exam for back pain may be somewhat helpful, and it's more accessible than medical testing, but also not as good, assuming equal competence. But a lot of physical exams aren't even competent. A theory versus practice thing. The best physical exam is somewhat helpful, but the best physical exam is not readily available. In the real world, ordinary people going to see ordinary professionals, manual therapists, often vomit up a torrent of overconfident and bogus claims about exactly what's wrong. In many cases, they aren't even looking for real problems. That is, they're looking for problems that don't exist in anyone. And what about the value of a physical exam from a particularly experienced and well-educated clinician? What about that ideal scenario? Is that worthwhile? Well, if you could be somehow sure that's what you were getting, that is much better. But I would still take that with a grain of salt. Medical testing isn't quite as shamefully corruptible by poor clinical reasoning, but it is definitely still not great on average. Why is it less corruptible? Two reasons. On average, more training experience and skill, and more objective data to work with. Physical exam involves very little hard data. and it's just easier for practitioners to get fanciful and irrational with it. But definitely, medical testing has its problems too. Consider how MRI is notoriously overused and abused. The medical tests also need better than average skill and knowledge to interpret wisely. I know a nuclear medicine specialist, a great resource for me, a good friend of mine, who has a lot of relevant knowledge to my work. He works for a clinic with a bunch of amazing medical scanning technology. While on holiday, a replacement doc for him with, quote, more relaxed standards for what we'll scan, did a PET scan for a back pain patient. PET scanning is a strange choice, and when I asked him if the report was interesting, he replied, "It may surprise you to learn that a test for metabolic markers of cancer and severe inflammatory diseases did not contribute new information to the case." So that's a fine and funny example of incompetent medical testing there for you. But back to the manual. Let's talk about special orthopedic testing. Most manual therapists aspire to the ability to pick up on subtle clues with advanced palpation skills and diagnostic cleverness and sophistication. And a great many doctors seem to avoid this like the plague because, ew, touching. Hunting specific biomechanical boogeymen is the whole basis of some professions. Most obviously chiropractic, where the whole point is to correct spinal glitches, which must be found first, of course. Similarly, massage therapists cannot release trigger points if they can't point to them, and physical therapists cannot prescribe corrective exercises, wisely or not, without something in mind that needs correction. To these ends, the body mechanic business has generated hundreds of special orthopedic tests to flush out the origin of pain. That's what it's called. They are called special orthopedic tests. Many of the people listening to this already know that, but I'm saying that for the benefit of a few members who are not healthcare professionals. It's a weird term, special orthopedic tests. It's kind of an unfortunate label that seems to want to be mocked. Many of these tests are named for the authority figures and pioneers who first developed and taught them. A classic example of a neck SOT, SOT, special orthopedic test, is Sperling's test, which checks for nerve root trouble in the neck by putting the head in a position where the nerve root can be more easily squished, and then pressing down on the head to see how sensitive it is. And a classic example of a back SOT is the SLR, or straight leg raise, also known as Lesagues test. She realized, looking at that name, I never actually said it out loud. It sounds really old school now, and I haven't heard anyone refer to it that way in a long time, and probably the last time I even read it in print was when I was in school 27 years ago. Anywho, it was originally called that, mostly called the straight leg raise. Now, the SLR checks for a lumbar nerve root compression by putting the leg in a position, straight, raised, that pulls on the sciatic nerve, which will probably irritate it if there's actually a problem. A lot of SOTs have this slightly sadistic quality. Does this hurt? How about this? I'm kidding, of course, sort of. Most clinicians are careful and respectful with how they perform the provocative diagnostic tests. Not everyone, but most clinicians. And some tests are just inherently unpleasant. It's unavoidable in some cases. I am looking at you, nerve conduction testing. It's more of a medical test than a physical exam. But virtually any, if you've got a really hot problem, highly, very painful, very irritable, then, a lot of these tests are going to be uncomfortable by nature if you're in real trouble. Maybe these special tests aren't so special. Many of the special orthopedic tests aren't particularly special in any sense, and some barely even deserve the name test. They aren't all bad, of course. Some are rather clever and elegantly simple, but many others are just simplistic, blunt instruments that were probably never a good idea to begin with. Some are based on outdated yet still common ideas about how conditions work and what we should even be looking for. Some are simple to perform but do require experience and wisdom to choose and interpret. And wherever experience and wisdom is required, it's often going to fail. Others are actually difficult to perform, and with more complexity comes less reliability. Even when the principle is sound, the special orthopedic tests are often warped by clinician fallibility and overconfidence. In the messy art of a physical exam, it is extremely easy for a pro to look only where the light is, the streak light effect, or see, feel, hear only what they expect to, confirmation bias. And so, because of all of those problems, and probably others I didn't list, special orthopedic testing has a long, embarrassing history of sucking, as the science will show as we continue below. Clinicians feel blessed, though, by an illusion of knowledge and certainty. Doing special orthopedic tests makes you feel special. I speak from experience. When I learned this stuff as a massage therapy student, I definitely felt more special. I thought, I am getting insight into how this business works. This is what distinguishes me from lesser trained professionals. And just a trivial, boastful reminder that I got unusually good training for massage therapy, much better than the average globally. Still entirely inadequate, but much better than average for a massage therapist. Anyway, I felt special. I did. And that doing these tests gives clinicians the sense that they are generating knowledge and certainty about a case when they're not. They're effectively guessing at the diagnosis guided by extremely sketchy data. If only I had a buck for every time that I heard something like this. It's my sacroiliac joint, my physiotherapist told me. Patients get told this kind of thing a lot. The sacroiliac joint is an especially popular scapegoat, it's a good example. I've got a whole chapter about that in the back pain book. But there are many reasons to doubt that the sacroiliac joint is a cause of pain nearly as often as it is diagnosed, beyond the fact that there are just so many possibilities. For instance, consider its legendary toughness. Here's a quote from Peter O'Sullivan, a professor of musculoskeletal physiotherapy in Perth, Australia. He writes, I talked to a trauma surgeon that had been to a workshop where they talked about the sacrum being out of place. He said, this is ridiculous. We see people who are in motor vehicle accidents with every bit of their body smashed, but the sacroiliac joint is intact. It is so strong. So patients are routinely given specific patho-anatomical explanations for their back pain based on the results of special tests, and it all seems quite impressive to the patient, but a great deal of it is probably nonsense and a misleading waste of everyone's time. Here is a featured science example. I'm going to go through a bunch of studies below, but I picked out one that I felt was a particularly good science example of the problem with finding herniations manually, failing to find herniations manually specifically. So let's begin the science with a 2010 paper by Wint. That's W-I-N-D-T, Windt, Wint, which is about physical tests for a disc herniation causing low back pain with leg pain. Also known as sciatica. This is from 2010, so not exactly a fresh citation, but acceptable. I'd like to cite something newer, but there hasn't been a lot of research on this lately, possibly because the verdict was already quite clear by the early 2000s. So this will have to do for now, but not all old citations are obsolete. Wint et al. Looked at all the data up to 2010, and found that, quote, diagnostic performance on most physical tests was poor. A few tests performed slightly better, forward flexion, hyperextension, and slump. And the classic straight leg raise, it was quite sensitive. That is, it was good at confirming, but even that was probably partly an illusion. I'll circle back to that in a moment. And it was also not super specific.
too many false alarms, also known as overdiagnosing. Combining tests helped some, but testing combinations of tests has barely been tested, so not very reliable to try to tackle it that way. About the sensitivity being partly an illusion, they were testing the reliability of SLR on people most likely to have herniations defined, patients who had already been defined as candidates for surgery for disc herniation. So guess what happens when you look for evidence of a herniation in the people most likely to have them? You find more herniations, and you get fewer false positives. So it's a little bit shooty, fish-in-barrel-y, and that makes the test look better than it actually is, an illusion of sensitivity, a partial illusion, not total, which is a very good example of a research artifact and also of the distinction between reliability and validity. Reliability being how good a test is at producing the same results in the same conditions, and validity is whether or not it means what we think or even matters. So shooting fish in a barrel doesn't make someone good at fishing, and an apparently positive, you know, result for sensitivity doesn't necessarily mean that people are good at this kind of testing. So that's a fairly important aside. I want you to bear that example in mind as we go through a lot of these. So, you know, I get almost every time, in fact, that maybe goodish sensitivity gets reported by one of these, this applies. The same problem applies again and again and again in the literature. So while we can assume that there is some sensitivity, it is probably almost always or often exaggerated by that research artifact, by the effect of studying something in controlled conditions, you end up with a slightly screwy result. Anywho, the conclusion of Wint et al. Was, quote, when used in isolation, current 2010 evidence indicates poor diagnostic performance of most physical tests used to identify lumbar disc herniation. Oof. Not terrible. Not great. And if you can't consistently confirm herniations, which is one of the most glaring possibilities, then it doesn't bode well for manual testing as a whole, as we are about to discover. Let's do a little digression here. This is a sidebar in the post about diagnostic accuracy and common and confusing terms related to diagnostic accuracy. This is a good time to chat about these because the studies reference all of these concepts constantly. I've been avoiding writing about this for most of my career. I can't tell you how many times I've looked these terms up myself while working. I still struggle to remember the difference between sensitivity and specificity. I'm kind of getting it. It's taking a long time. Diagnostic accuracy is a loose category of concepts that all of these things stick in our heads about as well as the Krebs cycle. And in the post, I've got a link to an image. You might have seen it before. It's a popular nerdy meme. It's just a picture of the Krebs cycle, and it says the real Krebs cycle. Learn the Krebs cycle. Forget the Krebs cycle. Learn the Krebs cycle. Forget the Krebs cycle. Repeat ad nauseum. The Krebs cycle is impossible to remember, as everybody knows, and so is the difference between sensitivity and specificity. So, but don't glaze over. Listen carefully. Maybe this is it. Maybe you will, from now on, you will remember this. A sensitive test is good at diagnosing conditions that are actually there. It doesn't miss things. That's the key. Sensitive tests don't miss things. I remember this one by thinking of it as sensitive to reality. Specificity is harder. It's the mirror image. And I just try to remember sensitivity, and then if I need to think about specificity, I flip the script. A specific test is good at avoiding accidental diagnosis of conditions that are not there. That is, it doesn't generate false alarms. So sensitive tests don't miss things, and specific tests don't generate false alarms. Two more concepts, validity and reliability. Validity is it's a valid test actually measures what it's supposed to. That is, the results mean what we think they mean. Reliability is probably the it's easiest of these concepts on the surface, but it hides the most complexity because there's a bunch of subtypes. But basically, a reliable test produces the same results under the same conditions. But again, many subtypes, like inter-rater reliability is different than, I don't have another one off the top of my head. Anyway, there's a bunch of subtypes. The thing that's cool about reliability to me, I think the thing that, you know, connects with the average person that, you know, they go, oh, that's an interesting idea, is just the idea that if you test the same, if multiple professionals test the same patient, they better get the same answer. And if they don't, that lack of reliability is pretty damning. That's an easy idea to understand, easy and important. So that's reliability. Right then, on with the science. Other evidence about the reliability of physical diagnosis. So all of this is basically an assortment of meh news about manual spinal diagnosis from the literature for both necks and backs. And there's actually curiously, as I was reviewing this before publishing, is surprisingly more about necks than backs. But the point is the same regardless. It all applies regardless of which part of the spine we're talking about. Back in 2007, King et al. Infamously refuted the results of a 1988 study by Joel that had become the go-to citation for the claim that manual therapists can diagnose symptomatic joints in the neck by manual examination. So back in the 90s, when everybody was, you know, everybody in massage therapy college, everybody in chiropractic college, everybody in physical therapy training, they were all learning that they could do this, that you could find the problem joint by manual examination. And there was a paper that was the go-to citation at that time, when there was, you know, if you think there's not enough evidence about this stuff today, it was really thin back then. And so 20 years later, almost 19 years later, King et al. Could not replicate that infamous old result. And instead, they concluded that manual examination of the neck, quote, lacks validity. Sad trombone. Also in 2007, which journal was it? I don't have that here. Some journal published a big review of the ability of physical exam and MRI to identify the disc, SIJ, sacroiliac joint, or facet joint as the source of low back pain. They looked at 40 other studies that tested such tests, concluding that their diagnostic power was, quote, usually small and at best moderate, and their value was unclear, was their word, unclear value. An updated version in 2023 focused more on medical tests, which had better results. And this is the main source of my assertion that medical tests are better, and yet still not great. And then there's this, the new version, right? So old version 2007, new version 2023. The new version, physical tests were mostly left out. They had barely any information about it. I suspect that is because they are mostly so underwhelming that they didn't even merit attention. For your edification, the only informative physical tests were, so in the updated version, this is all they had to say was, these two things are maybe helpful: a positive centralization phenomenon to identify discogenic pain, and the absence of midline low back pain, and a combination of sacroiliac joint pain provocation tests to identify sacroiliac joint pain. Okie dokie. So, you know, a couple of things may be helpful identified by that updated version. 2012 now, Main et al. Tested two physicians with training in manual therapy. So that rare breed of touchy doctor. doctors who act like physical therapists to see if they could detect the painful side by feeling for tension in the spinal muscles. And this is a very reasonable thing to test because it is a very common assumption that the painful side will be crampy, tense, stiff, hard, tight. But in almost 200 patients, they were correct for only 65% of low back pain and 59% of neck pain, barely better than chance. The results are underwhelming. They did a little better than just guessing, but those results suggest that it is difficult even for expert examiners to detect the epicenter of neck and back pain by feel. As well, they were only attempting to detect the side of the pain. Not the level, not the specific anatomy, the side of the body. Not exactly precise. A low bar to clear. Imagine how much worse the performance would have been if they'd had to identify the location more specifically, or if the pain could have been anywhere or nowhere. So they barely passed the easiest possible test and probably would have failed a harder one and done no better than guessing. An obvious weakness of the study is that only two examiners were tested. More experienced examiners might have yielded different results, but one would still hope for better than this from anyone with any training and experience whatsoever. In 2013, Al-Nazari et al. Reported that neurological testing had, quote, limited overall diagnostic accuracy in detecting disc herniation, which strongly echoes Wint in 2010 and Hancock in 2007. Accuracy was poor and, quote, all tests demonstrated low sensitivity. All neurological tests demonstrated low sensitivity, bad at confirming neurological problems. Seems like a poor result for neurological tests. In 2014, Hanny et al. Was a small but interesting trial comparing the results of physical exams of patients with mechanical neck pain done 2 days apart, no treatment between. Kind of an interesting design. So they did a physical exam of the same patients on 2 different days, 2 days apart. And they found moderate at best agreement. So that suggests that either neck pain is rather volatile and or the tests just aren't that trustworthy. At 2 days, if it was a week, I'd go with neck pain being volatile. But 2 days, most cases of stubborn neck pain are pretty much going to be the same 2 days apart. They're probably going to be the same a week apart. They're probably going to be the same 2 weeks apart. But 2 days is very little. Yes, these conditions, they can change fast. And so they could have, by chance, had people who changed between assessments, between exams. But I suspect it's much more likely that the exams were just not that consistent, not that reliable. In 2017, Le Meunier, I have no idea if I pronounced that French name correctly, Le Meunier et al. Did a sprawling series of scientific reviews related to neck pain in 2017, concluding that, quote, little evidence exists to support the use of clinical tests to evaluate the anatomical integrity of the cervical spine in adults with neck pain and its associated disorders. So that's not uniformly negative, hardly a promising way to sum up. They also reported preliminary evidence in 2017, quote unquote, preliminary in 2017. That's pretty recently in history to be preliminary. They reported preliminary evidence to support the use of the extension rotation test, neurological examination, spurlings, and the upper limb neurodynamic tests. In other words, they found some thin evidence that those tests might have some value at odds with some of the other evidences, including some that we've already talked about here. In 2018, Thumes et al. Reviewed the literature on tests for cervical radiculopathy confirmed by diagnostic imaging or surgery. Absence of evidence was their main theme. They set the bar high, and so they found none of the kind of higher quality evidence that's actually needed for this, which quote, seriously limits the level of evidence that they could report. So they didn't conclude much, except that clusters of tests might be used to increase or decrease the likelihood of a diagnosis. So here we are with the idea of testing combos again. So for instance, based on the tests with the most promising sensitivity and specificity, Thumes et al. Speculate that, quote, and by the way, I'll warn you in advance, this is going to come off like word salad, but that's kind of the point. A combination of a positive Sperling's test, axial traction test, and arm squeeze test may be used to increase the likelihood of a cervical radiculopathy, whereas a negative outcome of combined upper limb neural tension test and arm squeeze test may be used to decrease the likelihood. The point of reading that is, yeah, okay, a smarty pants could wrap their head around that, but that's really, really hard to remember, and it's uncertain to begin with, and it was in, you know, this is not, it's not like that was in a textbook that someone who graduated in 2018 studied. That's in one study that suggested maybe it was labeled as speculation. Maybe these combinations mean that is a nearly impossible combination of combinations. Three things that might increase the likelihood, and then two things that might decrease, that you would absolutely need a cheat sheet. I don't think there are many people alive who, even if they fully trusted that information, could actually remember it on the job a year later, or a month later, or in my case, 5 minutes. Like stuff like that just doesn't stick in my head, and I would have to reference it. But the point is, not only is it tortuous, it's also not even known. It's just, yeah, maybe based on the evidence, maybe these combinations could help you increase and decrease likelihoods. Sheesh. The meta point here, the reason I'm emphasizing this, is that even there with that, you know, evidence-based speculation, it's we're talking about something that's very difficult to do in the real world. Also, in that study, the evidence of higher sensitivity might be misleading, much like the example we discussed earlier. Let's do a summary of the evidence. That's a bunch of papers. What do I think overall? Well, there are many ways for a back to hurt that are simply impervious to physical examinations in the first place, in principle. Some problems just can't be ruled in or out this way. For problems that can be diagnosed in principle, the studies make it collectively clear that physical exams and most special orthopedic tests fall well short of being accurate, even under ideal conditions. In the real world, it's effectively a crapshoot, certainly from the perspective of the patient. There are just too many things to look for, too many ways to do it, and too many ways for it to go wrong. Once in a while, a specific diagnosis based on some clever and skilled testing is going to be correct. It's going to happen. I believe that's possible. I'm not denying that. But how would we confirm it? Mostly we can't, unless it is later ratified by medical testing and or a brilliantly successful treatment based on the diagnosis. And it's important to know this because so many clinicians act like they are diagnostic savants, like it's their whole thing to tell you exactly what the problem is. Sadly, it's standard for patients to walk out of a chiropractic office with a highly specific and wildly overconfident diagnosis. You're not bad at your job if you can't pinpoint the source of back pain. Once upon a time, I went through a phase of worrying that other healthcare professionals must be much smarter than I was, because they seem so good at identifying exactly where back pain is coming from. Also, they told me that they were smarter than I was. And that happened a lot, actually, in the phase of my career. Maybe it actually hasn't ended. For much of my career, I've been criticizing the excessive emphasis on relatively simplistic biomechanical factors in pain, what I call structuralism, and that provokes a lot of irate responses from readers. And a common theme in those answers, responses, reactions over the years is, you don't know, you just don't know what you're doing. a smart therapist, a good therapist, knows about these things and can identify them, and they do matter and they can be identified. So there, you just don't know what you're talking about. So they told me. And sometimes I kind of started to sort of believe them or worry that they might be right. I needn't have worried, nor should any professional suffering from the same neurosis. What my years of experience and study have taught me is that humility and restraint are wiser and less wrong than most of these specific patho-anatomical explanations. From Ben Cormack, a little quote here, having a bit of a rant about pseudoscience and amateurism in back pain diagnosis, quote, "The world's best researchers admit they can't reliably diagnose back pain. So why can you?" People do constantly talk like they know what causes back pain, or at least have a very strong suspicion. And it's almost always optimistic, is the polite term, I think. The specific mechanisms of back pain are mostly as impossible to know as what Bilbo had in his pockets. We can't generally trust professionals to identify a structural origin for pain, even if there is one, which there may well not be. We need a lot more diagnostic humility. And none of this means that specific causes don't exist, which is something I discuss in another chapter titled "It's Not Structure Except When It Is." But the evidence strongly hints that the causes you can point to on an anatomy chart are not present as much as anyone thinks. And even when they are, they're fiendishly hard to confirm and not as severe and consistently problematic as people assume and fear. Let's wrap up with a take-home message and a take-to-work message. The take-home message for patients is this: doubt every specific explanation for your back pain that you hear, especially the ones based only on a physical exam or delivered without any acknowledgement of uncertainty. Not just a grain of salt, I'm talking here. Full-blown caution is what I mean. Much more than a grain of salt. Doubt specific explanations. And my take-to-work message for professionals: by all means, do your exams. None of this means you shouldn't do your exams. What it does mean is that don't believe your own results. Think and talk about them with your patients in terms of the odds and aim low. You're not generating diagnostic conclusions. You're generating clues that change the odds and not as much as you'd like to think. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.